You are listening to another episode of Beckett's Babies, a playwriting podcast. Every week, we discuss plays we love, interview theater artists, and share our thoughts on playwriting and theater. We are your hosts, Sarah Cho.
And Sam Collier. And today we have a very special guest. We're so excited to talk with Erin Mallon, who's a playwright, author, and narrator of over 550 audiobooks with a special affinity for the romance genre. She's a six-time Earphones Award winner and five-time Audie Award nominee. Her audio play, These Walls Can Talk, is a 2021 Independent Audiobook Award winner for humor. Her play, The Net Will Appear, is now available on audible.com as an audio drama. And her other full-length plays include Good Riddance, Soft Animals, Hand Me Down, Stunning Displays of Prowess, Skin Hungry, and many more. Welcome to Beckett's Babies, Erin.
Thank you. That was such a fun intro. Thank you. Oh, that was nice. I'm psyched to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're so excited to talk to you. So we like to start off with early childhood memories. So what's the first thing you can remember? What was your life like before theater?
Well, I think I have to hit you with a two-parter. The first thing I really remember that not pound puppies were a big thing when I was a little kid.
Oh my gosh, you're bringing me back.
Yeah. And I have two brothers. I'm the middle girl of two brothers, and okay. We're all 2 years apart. And I think I was only about three, maybe four. And so my older brother was six, little brother was like two, three. And we had this pound purry. They also had cats. Uh-huh. And we were fighting over this thing at the top of the stairs. And one of us let it go and it went down the entire staircase. And I swear to you, we all went down and we could never find it again. And we have no idea what happened to it. Yeah. And I don't know if I should ask my mom. I'm sure we did at the time, but we never found it again until this. And to this day, decades later, we're like, what the hell happened to that thing? It was like the house ate it or something.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was like my first mystery that I remember from childhood. But one that's always stayed with me is that I feel like as a kid, I figured out the meaning of life at five, and then I forgot it and keep forgetting it and have to keep remembering it. But I was outside playing with my brothers again, and I was on the swing, and I was like having a blast on the swing. And my mom was home all day with us, and she was a great mom, but, you know, she'd get frustrated. She's home with three little kids, and my dad didn't seem to really enjoy his work. He would come home kind of angry. And I remember thinking to myself, right now, my job is to play. Like, that's it. That is my job. Yeah. And I remember thinking, wow, it might not always be that way. So I like played the hell out of that day. And then later, as an adult, I'm like, became a playwright. And I'm like, that is still my job. And I forget it too often. And when I remember, things go much better. So your job is to play.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wait, I'm trying to... What's pound purry? What is
yeah.
that?
Well, the main thing was a pound puppy.
Oh, pound puppy. Uh-huh.
Yeah. They were little stuffed animal dogs. They were kind of like, they came after Cabbage Patch dolls. They were kind of like the dog version of that, I guess. If that sounds terrible. But then they did an offshoot and had pound purries too. They had cats. So.
Wow.
Stuffed animals.
I've never heard of this.
Yeah, you're probably too
large
young for
in
it.
My childhood. Were those the ones that, no, maybe not. There was this one line of stuffed animal dogs that like you would open their belly and there would be little babies inside.
Oh, wow.
I feel like that was a different brand.
Yeah, I think it was pregnant dogs. I didn't play with any pregnant dogs, but.
Oh, you missed out.
I guess so. Damn.
Oh, all right. So could you talk to us a bit about your journey? Like just how did you get into theater or writing plays and writing? And
yeah, I got into it through dance, really. I was a dancer from the time I was, I think, like six or seven. And I really thought that was what I was going to do my whole life. I I was dancing like 6 days a week. I was on competition teams. I was traveling.
Wow.
Yeah. And then when I got to high school, they had auditions for plays and musicals. And so I auditioned just thinking I would be in the chorus because I love to dance. And I got an understudy role. It was for The Mystery of Edwin Drood. Did you guys do musicals?
Not really.
No. The Mystery of Edwin Drood was pretty cool because it was like a kind of like a choose your own adventure type musical. So the audience would vote on which lovers got together.
Oh, that's cool. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And what ending they wanted to see. And I got to understudy the MC for that. And that was it was a male role. And I got to understudy that and study the role and, just hang out with the senior girl all the time and watch what she was doing. And I got one performance for understudies only. And it was amazing. So much fun. And I was like, oh my God, when they let you speak, it's the best. And then I just started auditioning to be in all the plays and kept dancing throughout high school, but then became a theater major and didn't actually start writing plays until I was a few years out of college. And initially I thought it was to write roles for myself. Sounds weird saying it now. But the very first play I wrote, I realized as I was thinking about myself too much as I was trying to write my first play, I just said, well, forget that. Just learn how to write a play. Just try to tell the story. Forget about yourself. And then I've never been in one of my plays because I'm much happier being the one writing them now. Yeah.
I think that's so common that people start off by wanting to write roles they would want to play.
Yeah.
And then somehow it gets so much bigger than that.
Yeah. Like it knocked me out the first time that I was sitting in an audience in the back row in the dark watching a play I wrote and no one knew that the playwright was in the back. Like, I wasn't getting any attention. It wasn't about that. But hearing them laugh and seeing them enjoy something up there, it surpassed being on stage for me. And I was shocked because I thought that was everything to me. Turns out it wasn't.
I know. It's such an amazing feeling. It's like, and then you were hooked.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
How did you get into audio plays and audiobooks?
So I pursued it pretty determinedly. So when I was acting, I had been doing some commercials and voiceovers and radio spots. And it was just like what my agent would send me out for occasionally, and realized that I really enjoyed it. I loved the technical aspects of being in the booth. And it reminds me, this one time, one of my acting teachers said to me, she said something like, I don't think it was the greatest thing to say to a young actor, but she said like, Erin, you're very talented, but here's your problem. You don't want people to really see you. And I was and I was like, what? I was like, of course I want people to see me. And she was probably talking about something deeper than just eyeballs looking at me. But it's interesting to me that my acting world started to shift to where you literally cannot see me. So I'm hopefully you can see and feel like what I'm portraying, but I'm in a little box. Like that's where I am right now. I'm in a tiny little box, my studio. And I find great freedom in that, telling stories where you get to play every character in the book. Doesn't matter what you look like. It matters a little bit what you sound like, but you have to play everyone. So you're shifting your voice and you're doing dialects. And it just opens you up to every kind of role that if it was my body on stage, you would think certain things. But since you can't see me, you don't know. So anyway, I just knew that I loved it. And at the time I was teaching yoga as sort of my side job. And one of my clients was an audiobook narrator. And so we did a little barter where I would give her free yoga lessons and she would put me behind her microphone and and give me lessons and tips. And then she got me one of my first auditions at Audible and then it just started rolling. But that was 10 years ago. It was slow going in the beginning. And then about 3 years in, I was able to make it my full-time job.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really feels like audiobooks kind of exploded in the last few years. I was telling Sam last week, I downloaded this app called Libby app, which is you could download through your public library audiobooks. And I just started listening to some audiobooks this just recently.
Yeah.
And it's like a whole other experience that I've just – because before it was just podcasts, and that was probably the only thing I was listening to. But now, like, I've ventured into audiobooks.
What kind of stuff are you listening to?
I was listening to this, like, nonfiction called what's it called? Oh, my gosh. My brain farted.
Well, you're listening to nonfiction. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm trying to remember. You know what? I have the app. I started listening to People We Meet on Vacation by Emma Henry. I just started listening to that one.
That book is huge.
Yeah. That's so far that's been really fun. Yeah, I love like the music. So like adding some little elements like that, like music, and it feels like a real production.
I haven't listened to that one, but I know Julia, the narrator, and she's awesome. But I didn't know they were adding music to that one.
I guess I'm just speaking in general. Like, but it just like it feels like there's elements, and this person also does like the different voices, and so that's just something I've been noticing. Some of the audiobooks is like there is like an element of production that goes into it that instead of just one person just speaking the entire time.
That's so fun.
Yeah.
Well, there's so many – it's really cool. There's so many different ways you can go these days. And just like anything, there's people that love a certain process, and others are like, hell no, I never want to listen to that. Like you can have one narrator telling the whole 10-hour story. And it's like solo narration. And then you can have a duet, which happens a lot for us in romance. I do a lot of romance. And so the male point of view chapter, he does that. And then I do the female point of view chapter. But inside those chapters, his character comes up. So I also have to have a reasonably good male character voice, especially in romance, because you want to believe that these people are falling in love and you don't want to be taken out of taken out of it by like, oh, that girl is doing a really lame male voice, or vice versa.
That's so interesting. So do you record them separately so you don't hear each other?
Well, it depends. So
for
what I just described, we do it separately because there is no overlap. We connect ahead of time. So we'll send each other voice samples of here's where I think her voice sits. Here's how I'm playing the mom, stuff like that. So we're on relatively the same page. But then we work by ourselves. But then there's multicasts, which is what we're doing with audio plays. And some people are doing it with their books too. So it's it becomes more of like a sensory experience where I will only play this role the entire book. Which is very rare, but very much like theater. So it's a ton of fun for me.
Yeah, I listened to, years ago on a long drive, I listened to The Year of the Flood by Margaret Atwood, and I didn't know it was going to be a multicast. I thought it was just going to be like a regular. And this, I was listening to it on CD.
Wow.
Because that was the only thing my car could play. And it was so exciting when I started hearing different voices. And then there was singing in that book. So it was just very alive and
awesome.
Dynamic to have all those different voices.
Nice.
So how has your work with audio – oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's been a really interesting year for audio, which it sounds like you're kind of talking about too. Because, I mean – terrible year, and yet gratefully our industry wasn't affected like our theater industry was. So someone like me who writes for the theater but also works in audio, I just did a real hard pivot because I could take all my stories and put them in audio because I've been producing audiobooks for other authors for years. So I knew how to do it, and I could still tell stories in people's earbuds instead of in front of their eyeballs. So I've been very grateful for that. It's been an awesome thing to be able to do this year. made me miss theater a tiny bit less, and I'm very excited to get back to it for real.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering how all that audio work has influenced the way you're thinking about writing for the stage.
Mm. Yeah, it's a great question. It's one thing about this year in general, it's made me focus more, I think, on the stories themselves, the stories that I want to tell, the stories that excite me, and then think about sort of the container for them, the genre for them second. So theater is like my heart and soul. I want to do it forever. But ultimately what's under that is I want to connect. I write a ton of comedy, and sounds like you both do too. And I feel like that is what softens people. That's what gets us to relax our shoulders and laugh and be together. And then maybe we hit them with some other stuff because we're open and pliable now. I've been focusing on the stories themselves and then figuring out where they want to go. So when it comes to audio, what is something kind of intimate that I want to almost, not literally, but almost whisper into your ear? I picture that person sitting there alone with their earphones on. What kind of story do I want to tell them? And then what kind of story would be more powerful when you have 200 people surrounding you and you're having a collective experience? Those are the kinds of questions that I've been asking myself. And usually the story tells you where it wants to go. Does it want to be a book? Does it want to be a play? Does it want to be an audio experience? And it's so cool that we can experiment with all of them, because the storytelling would be different if I know I'm going to see you, as opposed to just letting my imagination go for a wild ride with the author. It's just different. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, that's super cool.
This is making me think, this past year, I've noticed a lot of the conversation about, you know, rethinking theater, reimagining it. People who are new, like media artists, kind of exploding into theater, doing these like really extravagant Zoom plays, you know, pulling in all these digital effects. And I'm so curious, like, how you talked about pivoting. What do you hope theater, like this, like audio drama, like is there part of you that kind of want to keep this staying, like stay the same, that we continue to explore these other ways of doing theater?
Yeah, I don't want the status quo. I mm-hmm. want theaters to open, and I want that experience again. But I do want to keep experimenting with what all of these things can do. It's been interesting too. It's been unique reaching out to like my readership. Like now that I'm writing books, and now that like people in the romance audiobook industry, which is a niche industry, but if they know me, it's as a narrator. So it's been interesting putting my work in front of them as a writer now. And they're kind of like, oh, Erin's writing. And I want to be like, well, Erin wrote before she narrated. But it's an interesting opportunity for me now to introduce it to you in your world. So that's been really cool. But I've learned there are a ton of people that have never, ever, ever seen a play, ever. And it blows my mind, because I don't know how you avoid seeing a school play at some point, but many people haven't. And so a lot of people have been reluctant to listen to some of these audio plays. I think the word theater and the word plays, it resonates with them as something that is like, not for me. I don't do that. So now I'm actually going to do another little pivot, but it's more like a marketing thing, I think. And try to market them as scripted stories, instead of saying theater or play. Because they'll hear Audible always has the little 5-minute sample. So if they listen to that sample, they'll hear different voices. They'll hear that I have sound design. So they'll know they're not just getting a straight book. But I think calling it a scripted story might bring in more of a fiction audience without that, uh-oh, theater, I don't do theater feeling that some people have.
Interesting.
I think you're right. And I'm so curious about what people, what their first, like, what comes to mind in their heads when they see theater and they think, oh, I don't want to listen to that. Like, do they think it's going to be boring or do they think it's just going to be a lot of talking, you know, like.
Yeah, I might do a little poll or something.
Yeah.
Because I've had a bunch of people, I have a Facebook readers group, and I go to them and say like, oh, I'm doing this title or I have an early listen of this. And it's just it's a cool place for them to meet and for me to learn from them. And a bunch of them have said, I thought I hated audio plays, but I really like this one. I'm like, well, cool. I bet it's only one of the first two or three you've tried. So there's a lot out there that you could experience. I'll do a little poll, but my guess is they think it's like, I don't know how to phrase it, stuffy or like pretentious, highbrow, like something that just feels like not for all of us somehow. Yeah. And oh God, I think theater should be for all of us. All of us. And there's as many different kinds of theater as there are human beings. So theater is for everyone. It's just you got to find your jam.
Yeah. And I love that the audio theater offers people that kind of intimacy and that personal experience. Mm-hmm. That does feel very different from going and sitting in a.
Yeah.
In a theater, which I think is intimidating for so many people.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We got to change that.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about your play, The Net Will Appear, which we both listened to. And I really enjoyed those two actors and the story you were telling. Can you talk a little bit about where that play came from?
Yeah, so The Net Will Appear is it's a play between a 9-year-old girl and a 75-year-old man, and they're on their rooftops, their neighbors. And so the whole duration of the play, it's only about a 75-80-minute play, they're on the rooftops. And so it got its first production in 2017 at Miles Square Theater in Hoboken, New Jersey. And then the following year, they transferred it to Off-Broadway at 59E59 theaters. And Richard Masser is the wonderful actor who plays Bernard. If anyone listening wants to give him a Google, check out his IMDb. He's one of those guys that if you don't know his name, you've seen him in so many movies and TV. Like, I remember first seeing him in My Girl when I was a little kid, and he was the Dan Aykroyd's brother. He was the little girl's uncle, and that's how I remember him. Oh. And then It, Stephen King's It, he's Stuttering Stanley. Oh my God, freaked me out. He's incredible. And so we were in the same theater company and met several years ago, and I just fell in love with him and his work, and he's been so supportive of me. So I wrote the play before I met him, but then developed it with him and worked on it with him. And then we found this incredible kid who at the time, her name's Matilda Lawler. She was eight, almost nine when we started rehearsals, had never done a professional play. And she just came into the audition room and she was able to retain that childhood wonder and like, awkwardness is not quite the word, but like she kept adjusting her biker shorts her whole audition, and it was just so real, and she was so present, but she was an instant pro. It was incredible. And so we cast her, and the two of them were just amazing. But then the following year when we went to Off-Broadway, she got a role in The Ferryman on Broadway. So we so she had to step down, and we got another incredible kid. But then for this audio project, they teamed up again. So they got to reunite and work on it in the studio, which is really cool.
That's so great.
So this play was recorded during COVID, like during pandemic?
Yes, we recorded it. I'm losing track of time now. It was past really, really tough COVID times, the very first COVID times. But it was maybe about 4 months ago, 5 months ago, we recorded it. So we had two studios. They were in the same physical building, but they were in separate studios. And we, you know, audio narrators and actors who work in audio, they're very used to not seeing each other. But we thought for her, since she's incredible, but she's still very young, it would help if she could see his face. So we set up an iPad next to her where we screened him. And so he was in the booth next to her. So she could see him and work off of him into the microphone. Oh. And they did a great job. And it was interesting timing too, because I realized I basically have a social distancing play. It's the kind of play they don't touch. They don't, you could do it even during the pandemic if you were gathering people to watch. You could do it outdoors. So it is having a production this upcoming year, hopefully, fingers crossed. But it makes me happy to know that everyone will be safe no matter what, because they stay separate.
I know people were doing plays like you could really set it on roofs or fire escapes or something.
Yeah. Totally.
Porches. Yeah. That would work really well.
Thank you for listening to that. That was nice of you.
Oh yeah. It was great. And so I'm curious about what other plays and playwrights you've been following recently. Who's exciting to you in this moment?
Well, this moment's so weird, right? I feel like I want to know what everyone's been doing. Like I'm hoping and expecting there's going to be a really cool explosion of what everyone's been doing. I hope that's the case. So I'm thinking back to when I was at the theater like once a week. I live in New Jersey, about a half hour outside of the city. So once a week I would be in there. That was my goal, to see a show every week. So I'm thinking about like, what are the things I was watching before everything went down? And you know, something I realized, I don't know what this says about me. The plays that stick out to me are the ones that I felt very frustrated watching. And that's interesting to me, because there's so many things you can watch and think, that's a well-constructed play. I like that. Oh, that's nice. And like, but I don't remember the details after. So the ones I'm thinking about are Will Arbery's play, Heroes of the Fourth Turning. This was years ago, but I still think about Annie Baker's The Flick.
So,
funny thing. A friend of mine, a playwright, he saw The Flick on a different night than I did. And then we compared notes about it. And did you guys see it?
No.
We read it. Yeah.
Okay. So I saw it when it was at Playwrights Horizons. And this is how it was directed. So who knows? I actually haven't seen it on the page. I don't know what it looks like on the page. But the very first moment, you're sitting there and this like blinding light comes in your face. And it stays on you. It stays on the audience. At least it did in this production for maybe 30 seconds.
Whoa.
And you're like, what is happening? And then that light goes. It was like the projector light for the movie theater, but it was on you, and then it's gone, and boom, you're watching them clean up the movie theater. And I was talking to these two playwright friends, and we were talking about that moment, and the one playwright said, I was just sitting there thinking, why do you hate me? And then the other playwright said, oh, that's so interesting. I was thinking, why do you trust me? I thought that was incredible. And I had a very frustrating experience watching that play. But when we got to the third act, I don't remember the content now, but there was a monologue that one of the guys delivered that was so gorgeous. I would have watched the play 10 more times just to experience that again. So maybe I need frustration. Maybe they're like building tension in me and then releasing it. And maybe that's what they're intending to do. I'm not sure.
This is making me think, like, as a young playwright, I got so frustrated by like Pinter and Mamet. And now I'm thinking maybe I need to go back and reread them.
Yeah.
And see why, you know, I mean, I know why I was frustrated, but like maybe I would learn something.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, I love that idea.
I mean, I think we don't want to alienate people. We don't want to push people away, but I couldn't leave. I didn't want to leave. I was like, what's she doing to me? And I was here for it.
Yeah.
So it's a fine line, I guess. I know plenty of people did leave.
Yeah, I was going to say people did walk out of that production. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it so upended their expectations of what they were going to experience.
Right. Well, and there's, you could also get into like story structure and how there's so many ways to do a thing, but I think so many audiences think it has to be that classic build up, then there's the climax, and then there's the denouement, and then it comes down. And a friend of mine, she was like, well, that's like the male climax, that's like right. a male orgasm. And she's like, maybe we just want it to tickle a little throughout the whole thing. And I was like, maybe we do, I don't know.
But, there's so many other ways.
Yeah. But I think it takes experiencing a lot to be comfortable with that. If you think of a play as one thing, and then you're introduced to something that's not your idea of a play, it's so easy to say like, how dare you, what's she doing? What is that? But we're very lucky when we get to see a wide variety of stuff. Not everyone has that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think theater is such a unique experience of allowing the audience to have different experience, like emotional reaction to something in a new way. I feel like that's in theater is the only place that you could really experiment with that. It seems like, because just other forms of medium is like designed to, you know, trap like the narrator to narrate a certain way or to travel certain, the story had to travel a certain way to meet those plots. But whereas there's just so much wiggle room to kind of push and expand different ways of time, you know, how we can experience time in that play or the story. Yeah.
In a way you do have more freedom, and so then you're going to have more people who love and do not love it. It's worth doing.
I kept thinking one of the things I've just been thinking a lot more as I'm writing plays is like smells. It's just something that I've been trying to explore in terms of senses. Like you can't smell TV film, but I was like, theater, you could smell. But that's just something I was thinking about.
And you can feel like on your skin. I mean, it's just usually air conditioning or whatever, but what can we do with that? How can you engage more of the senses? We got the eyes, we got the ears, but there's a bunch of other stuff we're not doing, touching and smelling and, you know.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah, it's like that piece you watched from home where they sent you a box of supplies.
Oh, yeah. And
there was smells involved in that, right?
Yeah, yeah. I was watching this Zoom play, this one person Zoom play called Someone Else's House, which was like a horror story. And this man was like sharing his childhood story about the ghost he experienced in his childhood home. And the theater sent us a box of like cards with historical info about the people who used to live in the home, and a candle you light and scented.
Oh, that's cool.
So, yeah, it was a whole experience. I was like, whoa, this is so cool. And it made me really feel immersed into his story. And just, it was like a whole other level experience that, because I was honestly expecting like, oh, it's a Zoom play. I'm going to watch. Maybe I'll walk away, come back.
Right.
I was like, whoa, I was really immersed.
We took a two-dimensional experience and made it three-dimensional.
Yeah. We did. Yeah.
Well, that's really cool. It sounds like it gave you the focus. I didn't even think about this, but theater demands focus.
Yes.
I mean, you could drift off in your mind, but you can't be that jerk checking your phone or like.
Exactly.
But at home watching Zoom plays, you absolutely can be that guy. And you're not a jerk. Yeah. You're just used to doing it. So that's really cool. Well, you're giving me ideas. I like that. Super cool.
Okay, so here's some, I guess this is, we have a couple of questions before we move on to glistens. So what advice would you give to our playwrights who, because only because you have such a, you've kind of, you're crossing over different fields. Like, what mm-hmm. advice would you give to playwrights who are starting out and maybe starting to think that way?
Well, I think the main piece of advice I would give starting playwrights is to come up with your community, to rise up together and to create community from day one around your work. I think the beautiful thing about being a playwright is there is no one on this earth that can stop you from writing. Sometimes it feels like they can stop you from getting a big production up, but there are ways. Like when I first started writing, seriously, I would get, I have this company called the Brooklyn Generator, and we write plays in 30 days. So, I won't get into the whole thing, but the way it started was in my Brooklyn apartment, I would invite 12 actors and 6 writers to come to my apartment, and we had food and we each bought a bottle of wine, and we would pick 2 actors' names out of a hat and 1 piece of inspiration. So, So the first month we did like the poetry plays, and I found poems that I thought were amazing, and I put 6 poems in there. So then we'd split off. You picked your 2 actors, and that playwright would go off to a corner of my apartment, and we'd like interview the actors. What kind of roles do you like to play? What do you never get to play? Mm. What do you think of this poem? Like anything you want to ask them. And then we went and wrote a 10-minute play overnight, rehearsed it, and then performed it in a winery on Sunday. And we did that for 2 years. So we had like, we each had a ton of 10-minute plays. And then me and my buddy, his name is Bixby Elliott, a great writer, we decided to take that and shift it. How can we adapt this model for full-length plays? Mm. So now it's 30 days and 1 full-length play, and you write for specific actors. And I always find a lot of inspiration in that. Writing for specific people takes me out of myself. I don't think about being good or clever or fun. It's just I want to write a role for this person and do that. If you have 6 actors, then suddenly you're writing a play for 6 people and something new comes out. And that, I think, builds community. So anyone can do that starting out. Grab your friends and write and read and drink wine and something happens. You kind of have like a non-official theater company and you're writing and you're exercising. It's like a gym. So that would be my advice.
That's amazing. I love that. And that kind of quick overnight, you know, writing a 10-minute play for specific people, it's so exhilarating because you get this whole process condensed to just a couple of days.
Yeah. And it's a nice kind of instant gratification too, putting it in front of an audience right away too. We did them on book, so we directed them, but they were on book. And then you have all these 10-minute plays to send out to festivals and just get your feet in the door of theater companies. And
it's such great training because you find out so quickly what's working and what's not working.
Yeah. And then also I found, like, I took 6 of them from those early days. I kept picking 2 guys out of the hat. I always tried to have a mix of genders, mix of, you know, like a very diverse room. And I kept picking 2 guys out of a hat, like 8 months in a row. It was weird. Wow. So I guess I was learning how to write for guys, I guess. So I actually took 6 of my favorite and put them together and called them the Bromantic Comedies and put that in audio this year, which is really fun.
Oh, that's cool.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So here's a fun question that we like to, a little game we like to play with people. Name 3 playwrights, living or dead, that you would invite to a dinner party.
I think I would have to invite Lauren Gunderson. I don't know her personally, but I feel like that lady, she's writing wonderful plays that are clearly coming from her soul. And she's a hell of a business person. So
yeah.
I would love to talk to her. And she did great stuff at the beginning of the pandemic. Did you see all those classes that she was doing on Facebook?
I didn't because I'm not on Facebook. But
oh, man.
That's amazing.
yeah, it was really generous of her and very cool. And then this is kind of a weird answer. A couple years ago, I had to write a short play based on a play by someone else. And I was given, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this is right, Hrostvitha of Gandersham.
Oh my gosh.
She was born in the year 935. Yes. And she was a nun.
I know.
You know her? You know her? Yes. Oh, okay. You know her.
And she wrote plays about like pots and pans.
Yes. Like, yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you know her. Yeah. I thought her play was wild and wonderful. And I grew up very, very Catholic. So having a nun write kind of naughty plays delights me.
Amazing dinner guest.
I think that'd be fun. Yeah. Oh, I was supposed to do three.
One more.
I think also Christopher Diaz. He's a super cool guy. He lives near me and has little kids like I do. Mm-hmm. And his plays are so like muscular. The language and like the physical people that are in his plays, like they are moving and sweating, and his plays are just so like muscular is the word I think of. I think it'd be interesting to hear about how he does what he does and how he starts. And
cool.
Yeah.
What a fun group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think we've ever gone a nun.
Man. I mean, how cool that I love that you know her.
I think I studied her in undergrad. Like I think I was also assigned her for a project or something. And I was like, who is this 10th century German nun writing plays?
Oh, I love it. Awesome.
Huh. Cool. All right. So before we move on to Glissons, Erin, where can our listeners find you?
My website is super easy. It's just erinmalin.com. And I'm on all the medias, the social medias. So Facebook, I have a Facebook group called Erin Malin's Feisty Fitsies. That has to do with the book I wrote. And so if you're interested in audio plays and stuff like that, you could join us there. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram. I'm everywhere.
Amazing. Awesome.
Yeah.
All right, Glissons. So this is a part of our show where we share like the highlights of the week, what popped in, for us. And Sam, do you want to go first?
Okay. I know I'm like really behind the times, but I just moved from a small town in Maine to a big city in Colorado. And so for the first time ever, I ate a sushi burrito yesterday. Ooh. Which Sarah tells me is a thing that people have been eating for many years, but it was my first.
I don't think I've had a sushi burrito.
Oh, that makes me feel so much better. It's just basically it's just a giant sushi roll.
That sounds amazing.
It was really delicious. I highly recommend it.
All right.
Okay, so my glisten is Nick and I, we binged watched the entire series of Friends. We finished last night.
Oh my gosh.
In one night?
Oh no, not one night. It's impossible. Uh-oh. We were just binging it like every day for the last, I think a month, maybe a month.
Wow.
We watched all 10 seasons from the beginning. Nick never watched it.
He had never seen Friends?
He's seen Friends, but he never saw it from the beginning to the end. You saw like whenever it was on TV. So I watched it with him, and man, it was so crazy. Like bringing up all these like feelings I had. I was like, when I was a teenager, preteen, like seeing it for the first time, laughing at the same jokes. And so it was just fun to watch it with him. And when it was over, like I remember being really sad when it was over, and then seeing. Nick was feeling sad too. Like we're all feeling like this remorse of like, wow, it's really over. It's like Friends are gone. It's like,
Did you watch the reunion?
Yeah, we did. So he watched a reunion first.
Before,
and I was like, maybe I should watch it. We'll watch it. I'll give it a shot. And so we're watching. Now we're trying to figure out what's the next big long series TV show we could binge.
How about the West Wing?
No, thank you. that's too intense. I might watch we might watch How I Met Your Mother next.
Awesome.
That's like
so here's my question. How do you feel that Friends aged?
Oh, okay.
Did it feel very dated?
Okay, so in terms of the friendship and kind of like your group of friends, the things you go through in your 20s, 30s, like that felt really similar and relevant. The only thing was like, I thought it was really homophobic.
I was like,
oh my God, I can't believe, why is Ross like so anti like dolls and like his child playing dolls? And I'm like, and then just like a lot of cross-dressing and like being dressing like a woman. And I was like, this is so like, it happened and it was a little cringy, but it was also very like part of the like the bigger joke of this, the show, whatever it was about. So it the way they snuck it in was kind of weird. But and also one of the co-creators is gay. So I was like,
edgy? Reminds you how far a distance we've covered since we were teenagers. Like as a culture, we've moved so far away from what was considered funny 20 years ago.
Yeah. So those jokes, I was like, oh, it was a little cheap but it was, but that was, like, I think the only thing that I thought was felt really kind of weird and distasteful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Erin, what's your glisten?
This might sound a little lame, but I've finally joined the TikTok. And I resisted it for quite a while because I was like, I don't want to do another thing. But I'm starting to watch things and there are some people doing really beautiful stuff on there. Like there's a lot of lame stuff and there's a lot of, you know, self-obsession kind of stuff, but there's some beautiful people out there that are connecting with tons of human beings and telling stories really. And this one woman in particular that I just followed today, she goes, I don't know how she gets the permission to do this or if it's one place, but she goes to cemeteries and she cleans the headstones and then she tells people on TikTok about the people who are buried there.
Whoa.
Yeah. And so she, you know, you can tell a lot from a headstone if it's, you know, small children or if there's a couple people there and how they were connected. But then she does some research too to kind of uncover their stories. And I thought that was really beautiful and people are
loving it.
All, isn't it 30 seconds, like 45 seconds?
I think you can go up to 3 minutes these days. There's some way you can do that. But I think the ones that get most play are 30 to 60 seconds. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And 15 seconds too.
I love that you called it the TikTok.
I'm being cheeky. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Erin, for coming onto our show and just talking to us and sharing about your experiences.
Yeah, such a blast. Yeah, thank you.
All right.
Okay. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Beckett's Babies. If you enjoyed what you heard or learned a thing or two about playwriting, be sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast with your friends.
And if you'd like to reach out and share with us your thoughts on playwriting and theater, or maybe be a guest on the show, be sure to visit our website at www.beckettsbabies.com. That's www.beckettsbabies.com, and you can contact us there. Thanks for listening.